listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
So tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce a real sort of legend. I think you know who I'm talking about. Richard Russo, the chronicler of blue-collar America. He's written just a ton of novels, including Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Nobody's Fool, Straight Man, and Bridge of Sighs, as well as a short story collection, The Whore's Child. And then there was this little book called Empire Falls, which won this thing called the Pulitzer Prize. It was also turned into an HBO miniseries starring Paul Newman, Ed Harris, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Helen Hunt, and I think I made an appearance in that one too. He was born in Johnstown, New York. He received a Master of Fine Arts degree and a bachelor's degree and a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Arizona, all from the University of Arizona. He now lives and writes in Camden, Maine. In conversation with Mr. Russo tonight is Carolyn Kellogg. She is the Maine blogger, books blogger, at the LA Times. She does something called What's it called? Jacket Copy. Thank you very much. Where's my brain? She recently won the paper's editorial award for feature blogging. Her writing appears in the current issue of Black Clock and in the upcoming anthology The Devil's Punch Bowl from Red Hand Press. And if you've been watching C-SPAN's Book TV this weekend, you may catch her panel appearance at Book Expo. She grew up on the coast of Rhode Island, went to high school in New Hampshire, and spent an awful month one summer working as a nanny in Hyannisport on Cape Cod. Ladies and gentlemen, this evening's program will conclude with a Q&A, and we'll be passing a microphone around. So please wait for the microphone to ask your question. We want to hear it, and we record for podcasts, so it's important that we get you that microphone before you ask stuff. And we'll be selling books in the lobby, and there'll be a book signing immediately following this. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Richard Russo and Carolyn Kellogg to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I'm going to read you, I promise, a very short section here. The main character in this book, his name is Jack Griffin. He is a former screenwriter and now college professor. And we're not going to learn much about Jack and what I'm going to read, but we are going to learn something about his mother. I think the only thing I need to tell you as I get going here, there's a reference in here to in the section that I'm going to read to Bartleby. Jack's mother, when his parents divorced, she has remarried to a philosophy professor this time. She's an English professor. She's gone across the aisle to philosophy for her second husband, whose name is Bart, and she immediately dubs him Bartleby for all the things that he prefers not to do. By the time Griffin's parents got divorced, each claiming that they should have cut the cord sooner, that they had made each other miserable for too long, he was in film school out west, and he thought it was probably for the best. But neither had prospered in their second marriages, and their careers had suffered too. Together, or at least voting together, they had been a force to reckon with in English department politics. Singly, often voting against each other, they could be safely ignored. And the worst of their enemies now sniped at both with impunity. Of the two, his mother seemed to fare better at first, openly contemptuous of the young literary theorists and culture critics when she was married to Griffin's father. She had reinvented herself as a gender studies specialist and became, for a time, their darling. One of her old guilty pleasures, Patricia Highsmith, had become respectable, and his mother had published several well-placed articles on her and two or three other gay lesbian novelists. Panels on gender were suddenly all the rage, and she found herself chairing several of these at regional conferences, where she hinted to her large and largely lesbian audiences that she herself had always been open, both in theory and in practice, as regards her own sexuality. And perhaps he supposed she was. Bartleby, who had begun their marriage preferring not to argue and ended it preferring not to speak at all, remained philosophical when these innuendos were reported back to him. Griffin had assumed that his mother was exaggerating Bartleby's withdrawal from speech, but a few months before his unexpected death, going to the doctor was something else he preferred not to do, he had paid them a quick visit, and they had all gone out to dinner, and the man hadn't spoken a word. He didn't seem to be in a bad mood, and would occasionally smile, ruefully, at something his wife or Griffin said. But the closest he came to utterance was when a piece of meat lodged in his windpipe, turning his face the color of a grape, until a passing waiter noticed his distress and Heimlicked him on the spot. But his mother's self-reinvention, a bold and for a time successful stroke, had ultimately failed. When the university, mostly at her suggestion and direction, created a gender studies program, she, of course, had expected to be named its chair, but instead, they had recruited a transgendered scholar from, of all places, Utah. And that had been the last straw. From then on, she taught her classes but quit attending meetings or having anything to do with departmental politics. Unless Griffin was mistaken, her secret hope was that her colleagues, noticing her absence, would try to lure her back into full academic life, but that hadn't happened. Even Bartleby's passing had elicited little sympathy. While she continued to publish and run panels and apply for chairperson positions at various other English departments, her file by this time contained several letters suggesting that while she was a good teacher and a distinguished scholar, she was also divisive and quarrelsome. A bitch, really. Despite deep misgivings, Griffin had accepted the university's invitation to attend his mother's retirement dinner. There happened to be a bumper crop of retirees that year, and each was given the opportunity to reflect on his or her many years of service to the institution. Griffin found it particularly disconcerting that his mother was the last speaker on the program. He supposed it was possible the planners were saving the best, most distinguished retirees for last, though more likely they shared his misgivings about what might transpire. And putting her last represented damage control. When it was finally her turn, his mother rose to a smattering of polite applause and went to the podium. She was wearing an expensive, well-tailored suit only deepened Griffin's apprehension. "Unlike my colleagues," she said, directly into the microphone, the only speaker of the evening to recognize that fundamental necessity, "I will be brief and honest. I wish I could think of something nice to say about you people and this university. I really do. But the truth we dare not utter is that ours is a distinctly second-rate institution, as are the vast majority of our students, as are we." Then she returned to her seat and patted Griffin's hand as if to say, "There now, that wasn't so bad, was it?" What she actually said in the stunned silence was, "Here's something strange. For the first time in over a decade, I wish your father were here. He'd have enjoyed that." Thank you.
So since you started with Mom, and does Mom have a name, or is she just Griffin's mother?
I think she does have a name, but I'm damned if... Oh, yes, it's Mary.
Mary.
Mary, because... and his name was Bill, and it seems to me that when they were both in graduate school or thinking about graduate school... No, when they were trying to find jobs outside of the Midwest, they were really hoping...
What are they called? What is it called?
The Midwest. The only places outside of New England that they really considered taking jobs if they could get them together was William and Mary. Uh-huh. So that's but we don't get much play out of those names.
Yeah, they really in the text they're really just present as Griffin's mother and Griffin's father.
Right.
She's such a although the time period of the story she's not physically on the Cape with Griffin or his family as they go to two different weddings.
Right.
She's a huge presence. And she's kind of a perfectionist and exacting.
Mm.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what it was like to spend time with her as an author.
It was a lot of fun. As you can tell from that, I mean she's in her own way a kind of a wicked woman. She's a terrible snob, but she's also just a lot of fun. When I write my novels, I generally don't write about people that I don't have a lot of fun being around. Even the ones that like Griffin's mother. Can be trying. I still generally have a lot of fun following them around in all of their eccentricities. I've also said when I've been talking about this book, because I think she would want me to, that my mother, my own mother, was not an academic, and we'll just leave it at that.
Okay, so this goes a little bit against the grain of how your work has been talked about, but with this book, somebody at Newsweek got their knickers in a twist and asked if you were a misogynist.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said that you write only perfect bitches and perfect angels.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Griffin's mother, Mary, do you see her as...
Mother Mary, come to me.
Do you see her as a perfect bitch? I'm guessing that perfect angel is off the table.
It's off the table for Mary Griffin, yeah. I don't see her that way.
Yeah,
and the other character that if I recall correctly was kind of lumped into that that Newsweek article was Mrs. Whiting from Empire Falls. I have a great deal of sympathy for Griffin's mother in particular, and in some ways for Mrs. Whiting as well, slightly different characters, and I like and admire them for slightly different reasons. We're seeing Griffin's mother at a time in her life where she has become what she has become. But when we see her in flashback, in two or three sections, we see her as a woman who has in fact been horse traded. She has, her husband is a serial philanderer. One of my favorite scenes,
she's not innocent.
Oh, by no means. No. And as far as philandering is concerned, that's just one more thing that she does not want to be left behind. when they're on the Cape, one of the scenes where they're on the Cape, there's a moment when Griffin, as a boy, is looking down from a window of the cabin that they have rented, and he sees his parents in a way that we have not seen them before in the book, and we gather that he hasn't seen them either in what amounts to a tender moment where they say to each other something along the lines of, "Why do we do this? Why do we do this to each other?" And you see Griffin's mother in a particularly vulnerable light that makes us understand that a lot of what she does, the person she has decided to be, perfect bitch. I don't know, but she was at one time, I think, a very imperfect bitch, and a woman with whom we probably would have had a good deal, or we would have had more affection for if we had known her before she became as hard, as hardened, as life has made her. Mrs. Whiting, I liked in Empire Falls, another of these really strong to the point of domineering women, is that she is, I think, in that book, the sharpest knife in the drawer. She's well ahead of Miles Roby on almost every count. There's really only one thing that she doesn't understand, which is love, I think, and it will be her downfall. But there again, I think of these as fairly complicated women. That said, however, I don't want to appear as if I am defending myself against the charge, because back when I was teaching undergraduates and graduate students in fiction writing, we would always do these workshops, and you know, these sophomores in college would turn in a story, and then their fellow workshop members would just tear the story to shreds. And the rule in my workshop always was that you really only have one chance. You write the story, and if people criticize it unfairly, then that's just the way it is. That's one of the things you're going to need as a writer, is to be pretty tough. And the person whose story it was would say, but that's unfair. But I always demanded of them, suggested to them, that you only have one chance in writing the story. So build it well, craft it well, because it's going to have to defend itself against criticism. And so I'm just a little bit. Thank you for phrasing the question the way you did, but I don't want to appear as if I'm defending characters, because I think that these books, you build them like anything else that you make it with the best materials you can find to hand. But a writer can't run around the world on book tour defending his or her books. It's just, if you don't allow a sophomore in college to do it, then you shouldn't be doing it yourself as a.
So, you've got several books under your belt.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your most trusted reader? Who gets to see it before your work, before it comes out?
Barbara, my wife, is my first reader, and if she were here, she would probably say also my last, in that she gets to read the first draft that I show anybody, and then based on her reading, she's a very good reader, and based on her reading, I will often do a fairly complete revision before I send it to my agent, who also then comments, and I'll usually do some revision before I send it to my editor, who then edits the book, and then Barbara probably will read between, you know, when the galley pages start coming and all of that. Barbara will usually read a book of mine probably four or five times. So she's a wonderful woman. What can I say? She's first and usually last as well.
Well, I think she probably thought that Mom was a lovely bitch. it was really fun. I wonder if we can jump into a discussion about your parallel work as a screenwriter, because that kind of feeds into this book.
Mm-hmm.
You've been working on screenplays for a while. You've had a bunch of films produced. Mm-hmm. How does the process work differently? You work with a collaborator, right?
At some point, you'll probably be working with a fair number of collaborators.
But you yourself, don't you have a writing collaborator?
I have had. Mm-hmm. Robert Benton and I have made three movies together. I was introduced to Benton as he started writing the screenplay for Nobody's Fool. We immediately struck up a wonderful friendship. And we have made two more movies together, The Ice Harvest, which he co-wrote with me, and we made another Paul Newman film called Twilight.
The other Twilight.
The other Twilight, not the vampire Twilight. Don't go out and rent the vampire Twilight, expecting Richard Russo and Robert Benton. In the early, when I was learning this second craft, it was like studying with Yoda, or working with Robert Benton. So we did our three movies together, and we continue to look for projects. He's very busy with his, and I'm still writing novels and occasionally coming to film. But we talk together all the time and are always looking for other things that we might do together. And given our interests, and given the kinds of movies that are being made in this town right now, it's getting increasingly difficult for us to find things that we can do together and also get made. The kinds of movies that we like to make are clearly not the staple that they once were.
I was like, but one of your movies was on TV. It seems like some of the longer form films that you can do now you can do on television. Like Empire Falls was one of the earliest and best HBO long series.
I have been having this conversation today on a number of occasions because there are some producers that I have worked with and in the past and am working with, and they're people. We all are interested in making the same kind of films, and we're not only talking about the dearth of those movies, those kind of serious dramas. Or serious comedies, even that were being made 10 years ago, that don't seem to be made right now. So we are bemoaning that, even as we're kind of looking around and saying, "But you know what? We're living right now in probably the golden age of television. The amount of good serious drama that's being done on AMC, on HBO, on Showtime." And other venues are now coming on board too that have kind of filled that gap. So there is good work being done, and some of these longer forms that are not finding much of a sympathetic ear or eye, certainly in the studios, and the independents that are still trying to make these movies are having difficulty getting them funded. We're just looking now in different places. We're looking for different homes, I think, than we were a decade ago.
Your arc as a writer went from starting out in academia and then dabbling in Hollywood.
Right.
And Griffin's arc goes exactly the opposite way. He starts out as a Hollywood screenwriter, and then he ends up moving to academia. And I could wonder if you could talk a little bit about the tensions between the two. And I'm curious... which one would you prefer?
Which kind of writing?
Which arc?
Which arc?
Do you like yours, or do you like?
Oh no,
is
no,
his, like,
I,
a fantasy
mine is,
arc.
No, mine. I have the preferred arc. there's no doubt about that. I really snuck in the back door. I know all sorts of people who work in the industry, people who have graduated from film school and very talented writers who cannot get their stuff read. I came in, did that first wonderful project with Robert Benton, and suddenly people were at least back then offering me things. And so to come at it as an established novelist, a novelist with some readers already and a reputation as a writer allowed me to skip all those niceties like film school and paying your dues to in that particular industry. And I not only that, but I immediately started working with people like Robert Benton and Fred Skepsi, who did the miniseries of Empire Falls, and Harold Ramis, who did Ice Harvest, and that astonishing group of actors that I've worked with in all of these projects, and poor Griffin. I mean, Griffin did go to film school, and by the time he's finished his screenwriting career, for the most part, he's doing kind of, would have been back then, really, really crappy made-for-TV movies, because that wasn't, when he was doing it, that wasn't
he's,
the golden,
he's doing like
that
the
was
lifetime,
not the golden age of television.
Like the Lifetime special.
Yes, and so he's, so he's his and so he's getting into academe towards the end of things, and I think part of his being disgruntled at the beginning of this novel is the fact that he has now become what he has always sworn he wouldn't be. He's an English professor, like his parents.
And yeah. You talked after Bridge of Sighs about having like sort of a shadow self or a parallel self out there. The idea of there being a life that you haven't led, in some ways, is Griffin. He's like stepping into the life that his parent he tried not to lead.
Yeah,
like he becomes his own shadow. And
that's very nice. I like that.
But it also seems like in some ways he's serving as a shadow for yourself. That you can work out, you can beat him up in ways you weren't beaten up.
Exactly, exactly. One of the nice things about this book was that I really had two kind of nice satirical targets. I had written my novel Straight Man, where I had lots of fun with academics, and so I could come back in this book and reprise some of that. But also have some fun with Hollywood too, which is also a fairly broad target. You should, if you can't hit that target, you really shouldn't be aiming anything. I was able to have some fun, because not many, I know a lot of writers who have had Hollywood experiences, but not many of them have had the kind of experiences that I've had. I once had a conversation with a, and I won't tell you his name, as a writer who's had several bestsellers, hadn't had much experience with the movies, and one of his novels was being filmed. They were shooting it in the desert north of Albuquerque, and they invited him to the set one day, and he flew into Albuquerque, long trip, and then got into a car and drove for like 2 or 3 hours into the desert. And as soon as he arrived on the set, all the actors came over one by one to introduce themselves and to apologize for what they were doing to his novel. So I was able to use, I know a lot of writers who have had these kinds of experiences that I have, again, been blessed to have missed, and have been able to work some of those into Jack Griffin's life, and there but for the grace of God. Yeah.
And he doesn't have much luck in academia either. I mean, the only time we see him doing any work, he falls asleep and his students' pages fly off a porch. There isn't much pleasure in his vocation for him. Mostly he just drives around Cape Cod thinking about his parents.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I he's a kid who's grown up in that world, and he doesn't take an awful lot of pleasure in it. And also, as you say, to be perfectly frank, he seems to have inherited the kind of the worst of his parents' abilities, such as they were, because Griffin's father was an enormously charismatic man and not a very good teacher. But he tended to attract athletes and frat boys,
a bovine yet willing graduate student,
and he would read, you know, a 15-page term paper and write at the bottom of it, "Could be better."
Not overly engaged.
And yet his classes were always enormous, because he always gave good grades and students kind of liked his charm and his kind of endearing incompetence. Whereas Griffin's mother always had very small classes, because she was an extraordinarily rigid and demanding teacher, so that only the best students would endure what you'd have to endure taking a class from her. And Griffin seems to have inherited kind of the worst of both of those worlds. I mean, he'd like to be as rigorous as his mother is, but that would involve spilling an awful lot of ink on these stories and essays. And he can't quite bring himself to dismiss their efforts like his father. So he is, I mean, genetically, he's in a kind of genetic gray world. He's inherited the worst of their temperaments and turned out to be, I think, a much worse teacher, really, probably, than either of them.
And we catch up with him when he's sort of in a moment of crisis, because, you know, that's what makes it a book.
Yeah.
He's having a crisis in his marriage, and there's a wedding. But one of the traditions in classic literature is that a wedding means that it's a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make it just about as tragic as you want, because you've got two weddings.
That's right. Two weddings and one funeral. That's true, and it is a comedy. I think it's a comedy in exactly those kind of Shakespearean, almost classical terms.
But yeah. You've done something really marvelous here, in that really what happens is Griffin goes to the Cape for two weddings, mm-hmm. but we get all this backstory and all this history. And so when there's this sort of incredible slapstick piece towards the end, this big set piece, if you haven't read it, just wait until everything gets chaotic. It's marvelous. you know where everybody is and what. There's tremendous meaning in all the silliness that happens.
Yeah.
But you make it look really, really easy to put a guy in a car and tell us a story. How did you approach the structure? Did you come in with, you can tell me that it just spills out that way? Or do you sort of know how you're going to fit things together?
Well, this book had a genesis a little bit different than most of mine, because my previous novel, Bridge of Sighs, was my biggest novel just in terms of the number of pages. It was also my biggest in terms of what I was after. It was just a huge book, and it kind of left me with when you run out of gas. That when the needle begins to bounce off the E, that's kind of the way I felt at the end of that book. And I didn't want to stop writing, because for me, that's the one thing I can't do. But I certainly didn't want to start another novel. So I thought what I would do is maybe write a screenplay, maybe write a story or two. And this started out as a story. So basically, I think what I did was con myself into thinking that that I would just write a short story. And it would be over, in and out, 20, 25 pages. I took Jack Griffin. He had just had a little tiff with his wife in the first draft. It was just a little tiff.
And
he heads to the Cape. He's got his father's ashes in the right wheel well of his car. And he knows that, as I envisioned the story, he would go to the Cape. And the story could end basically one of two ways. Either he would scatter his father's ashes, which he thought he really needed his wife to help him do, and he's kind of miffed at her because she didn't come to the Cape with him. She has duties of her own, and she stays behind, forcing him to scatter his own father's ashes without her help. And as I envisioned the story, he would go to the Cape, and if he failed to scatter his father's ashes, that could only mean one thing, that he really needed his wife, and he had better scamper his little behind back to her just as quickly as he could. And in that way, it would be kind of a happy ending to the story. On the other hand, strangely enough, if he did succeed in scattering his father's ashes, if he didn't need her help when he thought he did, then maybe what's between them was bigger. Maybe he doesn't need her for other things. But still, it seemed to me like, what's that going to take? 20 pages, 25 pages? And I got him all the way to Provincetown, and his mother called. And called him on his cell, and he pulls over to the side of the road. I was so close. He pulls over to the side of the road to answer his mother's phone call, and a seagull shits on him and he blames his mother for the seagull. And I thought, a man who would do that, you're not going to resolve this in 25 pages. You just, once the seagull is, once you've got a seagull, clearly you're not in the realm of short fiction anymore.
You need another chapter.
And so then I introduced a wedding. Both of my daughters were getting married. We were looking forward, actually, to two weddings. Both of my daughters got married when I was writing this book, so I thought, all right, we'll do a wedding. So pretty soon, you know, it went from a publishable short story to an unpublishable short story when it got a little bit longer, to a novella, which is unpublishable in any, whether in any way, to something that was even a little bit longer than a novella. And then there was the day that I kind of woke up and realized that if I could milk this for another 50 or 75 pages, I might have something that could be fobbed off on an unsuspecting public as a novel. And then I wrote another 200 pages. and it was a novel. It wasn't a typical Richard Russo novel, but it was a novel of some sort.
You once said of writing novels that the task is so enormous that if we ever really thought about what we were letting ourselves in for, we'd never begin. So how do you trick yourself? Do you just hide all the printout pages? Do you hide the pages? Do you have a tiny little file in Word on your computer that's only like 3 pages long?
I have all sorts of ways of deceiving myself. I had a very good writing teacher early on who said that if you wrote 2 pages a day, 2 typed pages a day, and if you put those 2 typed pages that you've written face down in a box, at the end of the year, you would not have a novel, but you would have something the size of a novel. And I thought that was truly wise advice. And the way that I deceive myself usually is to just live by that dictum. I'm to the point where I can write sometimes 3 pages a day, and I do write every day. I don't make any distinction between weekdays and weekends. And I'm kind of metronomic, and I just go back and forth And so at the end of a year or two, usually two, I have something the size of a Richard Russo novel. It's not a Richard Russo novel yet because it's completely screwed up. But but still, I mean, it's and if you've written something the size of a novel and you have generally for me it's 750 to 1,000 pages of manuscript. If you have At that point, you have almost no choice. If after you've written 1,000 pages, 2 pages a day or 3 pages a day, you'd be an even bigger fool. I mean, you were a fool to start, but having gone 1,000 pages, you'd be an even bigger fool to quit now. So those are the basic strategies, I think.
So Griffin is at work on a short story.
Yeah.
And he's basically spent 50-some years, and he's got like one short story that he's working on.
Yeah.
He works a little slower. He's like a sentence every day. but he, you do this trick again where you tell us that he's working on a story. Then all of a sudden we get the story.
Yeah.
And it's really lovely. And then we sort of come out of it. And Griffin says it had been the stuff of good fiction, he knew, but he somehow managed to mess it up in the telling.
Mm-hmm.
So, on the one hand, he didn't. I mean, the version we get is a lovely version,
mm-hmm.
but Griffin's dissatisfied with
right.
it. And you're sort of coaxing us into telling us how to read your book.
In a way, there's a kind of metafictional aspect to all of that, a story about stories and how stories are told.
And at one point,
and
he
also
says,
why they fail.
At one point, he says, if there's a false note at the beginning, that then you're really done for.
Yeah.
And I think he's talking about screenplays, but have you gotten those 1,000 pages together and then looked at the first pages and gone, oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Part of the reason that the tank was on empty was that happened in Bridge of Sighs, actually. I was very close to I was probably 750 pages into it, and the structure was all wrong. And I thought at one point that I had three different books. And I simply could not make the book work. I had been staring at it for a very long time. And it was exactly what Griffin was saying, is that it's like the foundation of something. The term that he uses in this is plumb. What carpenters? It's a carpenter's metaphor for when you're building something. If you're half a bubble off you're half a bubble out of plumb. That's fine if you're only going up two or three stories, but a novel goes up a lot of stories. And if you're half a bubble off on the first story, the second story, it doesn't make an awful lot of difference. You're 70 stories up, that sucker tilts. and so when a novelist makes a mistake, a kind of huge mistake that can, something's wrong with the conflict or you don't know your character well enough to write the book, or there's something wrong with the structure of the thing, something fundamentally wrong with the structure, you can build and build and build, but it's going to get more and more and more out of whack. And it's as bad a feeling, I think, as a writer can have, because your first instinct is always to say that you'll find the solution. If I just keep going, I'll find the solution. It'll come to me. And that day, 2, 3, 4 years into a book, when you realize that feeling, that sinking feeling, that you've been conning yourself all this time, and you're thinking, well, you fixed the other ones, why shouldn't you be able to fix this one? And you've pulled all the tricks that you know of to get yourself out of this. And then there's that terrible black day when you cannot fool yourself any longer. Until you fix this, until you find out what's wrong with it, it's never going to get fixed. And you've been staring at it so long you can't see it anymore. You can't.
That sounds a little bit like what's going on with Griffin's marriage.
Well, and the most discouraging part is that sometimes the problem, whether you're talking about a student's work or you're talking about your own work, sometimes that the problem is not in the work. Sometimes the problem is in you. You cannot deliver on the promise, the meaning of a story, if you yourself don't understand the story you're telling. And I think that that's Griffin's problem, both in his marriage, in a way, and in the story that he's trying to tell, is that there's something fundamental about the story that he's trying to tell that he doesn't understand. So the problem, in a sense, is in the story, but more importantly, it's in him. Until he figures out what's wrong with him, the story's never going to be right. Until he figures out, I don't want to ruin it for any of you who have not read it, because it's kind of fun when you read this book trying to figure out what's wrong with Griffin's story. Because it has a lot of nice elements to it. It does. But he's made a fundamental mistake that is located deep within him. He's tried throughout the telling of this story, all the different drafts he's done. He's had one basic goal in his life, in his marriage, in everything that he does. He is so appalled by his parents' snobbery, by their values, that he has decided he's going to do everything different. Whatever they did, he's going to do the opposite, and he's going to find his own path. And he doesn't realize that, of course, you don't find your own path doing that. They're still in charge of your life if you're going to do the opposite from what they do. You're still not making a decision. You're just doing. They're still, in a sense, running things. And so, in this story, he has tried to keep the parents out of the story, just as he's tried to keep them out of his life.
And even when they're in ashes, all they do is sit in his head.
Exactly.
All they do is talk to him.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a terrible moment for a writer in a novel when you come to that realization that you cannot. There's always the possibility that the problem is technical. And thank God, in Bridge of Sighs, what happened was that I gave the book to my agent, who read it and explained to me what he thought was wrong with it, and it was structural. But the deep fear that we all have as writers, I think, is that you get to that point in a book like Bridge of Sighs, and you realize, as Jack Griffin does, that the problem is not technical. The problem with your story is you. And that's a terrifying thing.
A lot of your stories have been set on the East Coast, mm-hmm. and in small towns. Mm-hmm. And those small towns are often under threat by development, by sort of this sort of march of progress. Mm-hmm. So I'm switching gears here. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the changes in the economy have resulted in any change of that sort of march of progress in the towns that you pass through. And is there another kind of story to be told?
I just finished a very a long story that deals with a lot of those things.
And where will we find it?
Well, and that's an interesting story in itself. My younger daughter, Kate, is a painter, and she is married to a sculptor who is also a photographer and also loves books, and he loves the design of books. And this summer, and I'm sure throughout the coming year, we are going to do a project together, the three of us. My daughter, Kate, is going to illustrate three stories and a long essay. Two of the stories will have been already published. And there's this new story, this long new story, which, if I can get it fixed, will be another. And then a long piece that I've just finished for Granta Magazine, which will be coming out, a nonfiction piece, which will be coming out. And our idea for this is I'm sure, the dumbest idea we could possibly have, but, you know, as we know, the only good causes are lost causes. And so what we're going to do is hopefully, between the three of us, create what we hope will be a beautiful object. That is a book that's illustrated with the kind of lushness that we don't generally see anymore, at least in adult books. You see it in children's books. But we generally don't see it in adult books. And it will, I hope, feature Kate's illustrations and Tom's wonderful design. And we'll make it into a big, an outsized book. It won't be outsized in terms of its words. It'll be a relatively short book, at least by Richard Russo standards. It'll be a relatively short book. But it will also be a book for which there would absolutely be no imaginable purpose for an electronic edition. It will not be sold on Kindle.
Okay. Have you seen the iPad though? It's really pretty.
Yeah, I know. But what we'll do is a limited. I think what we'll do is a limited edition. We'll do no more than 1,000 copies, hopefully just a book that will please ourselves create a beautiful object. Yeah, I think we're all worried about the book business right now and wondering what the solution is. We certainly don't want it to follow the newspaper business, and we're all wondering what in the world the book business is going to be like. Everybody's wondering what the book business is going to be like in a decade, but it's 5 years, what the book business is going to be like. One of the things that I think maybe has to happen to books is that those that remain have to maybe become more beautiful. So we're going to try something anyway. See.
Have you ever had one of your novels be published with illustrations before?
No. Just let my voice fall. No.
Because, you know, it's interesting. There was a tradition, like Twain and Dickens, mm-hmm. their works, when they were originally published, were published with illustrations.
Wonderful illustrations. Dickens had five of the best illustrators in London during the course of his career. Yeah.
So it's as if publishing sort of forgot the beautiful object at some at some point along the way.
I think so. And so we'll see. This will be kind of a, it's a notion. It's a notion. We'll see.
I know we have to open it up for questions. I mean, yes, I believe so. Okay. I have some, but let's see what you guys have. Don't be afraid.
Yeah, okay. That first one is always the hard one. Shoot your hand up.
Over here, maybe?
Well, I'm just back from a book club reading last mm-hmm. night, and so I'm here as kind of a representative of my book club. And one of the questions that they were very concerned about was joy. Uh-huh. They just felt, I wasn't so concerned, but maybe I have all the wrong reasons for not being concerned.
And Joy is Griffin's wife.
His wife, yeah. And they were concerned that she, like, who was she? And they
oh, okay, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I thought you were concerned about my own marriage. As a matter of fact, the first during the hardcover of this book, we spent a lot of time in New England, and for the first 2 weeks, Barbara actually went with me on book tour everywhere because she wanted a show of solidarity to let people know that no, we were not divorcing, and the book, at least in that respect, was not autobiographical. I like Joy a lot, and she's a bit of a cipher in this book, in that Griffin, because we're in Griffin's thoughts all the time, we get an awful lot of his thoughts about her. And also, but we don't see her in a lot of actual scenes where she speaks for herself until the end of the book or in the second wedding. She actually comes on the scene and becomes a character whose motivations we then become a little bit more privy to. I kind of like, my favorite aspect of Joy is the young Joy when they are young and when she and when he's. Screenwriting, and I love most about her is her generosity toward him over the years. I think you can only call it love, but this is a woman who I suppose in a way you could say maybe has married the wrong man in the sense that. She comes from a loving family, and despite the fact that she has difficulties with her parents
and two crazy brothers,
she does love her parents, and that's kind of what gets in the way of their marriage. And because of that, Griffin is in some ways the exact wrong guy for her to be married to. And at one point, when they're younger, and he has a screenwriting partner. She falls for another man, and the way in which she deals with that, the way in which she makes her marriage to Griffin work, is something that I just have great affection and admiration for. But I kind of understand what your book club is saying is that that in some ways she's probably more vivid as. This is a book about the past and the way the past impacts our present on how just impossible it is to shut up our parents after they're dead. And so, as with a lot of this novel, whatever's happening in the past tends actually not only to be more interesting than, but also to be more vivid than what's happening in the present. Yeah.
She could never become a character, which is why I didn't have a problem with her, but I didn't know maybe I was projecting all kinds of other things onto the reading, which I guess we all do.
Yeah.
But they were troubled because I think maybe they wanted to know more about her, but they couldn't access her because he didn't seem to really be able to
Yeah, yeah. I think we're seeing that through his eyes. And as he becomes more, we're watching a guy kind of circle the drain here in this book. And as we follow him in his circling motion, as he become more and more self-involved, until he can figure out a couple of basic things, we're not going to get a real clear picture of anybody, and including. Towards the end, too, I think we have that same problem with everybody that Griffin is looking at. Some of my favorite parts of this book are about his inability to come to terms with and to know certain things. Those wonderful, for me, those sections when his mother is dying and she goes into her kind of morphine state. And she starts trying to rewrite history. And as he's looking at her and watching her suffer, I think there too we have trouble looking at what he's looking at, and knowing where the truth is. Where does the truth lie? Given the filter, the prism that we're trying to see things through.
There was you and the green were first, I think. Down here. Yeah. And while you're walking down there, Justin, I have a question from Twitter from you from earlier today.
Twitter?
Yes. I asked Twitter what they would want to ask.
A tweet.
And someone asked, what's the most inaccurate or wild assumption people have made about you based on your characters?
I have no idea. what's the most... They might think that I'm less happy or less content than I am because I write so much about marriage, and marriage, it's the marriages that are in trouble that are, of course, the most interesting. Just like people, individual people who are in trouble are more interesting. Which is again to go back to why my wife wanted to go with me on the early portions of this of this book tour. But I think that people who read a book like Bridge of Sighs, that's a book about despair, and I followed a character into some pretty dark places. But if you read that book and you read this book, despite the fact that I think of it as a comedy, it's a book about this marriage that's kind of imploding, and several of my other marriages and other novels have kind of imploded, and I think people might just think that I'm like Hank Devereaux and like Jack Griffin and Lucy Lynch. They wouldn't realize what a happy-go-lucky guy I really am.
I wanted to ask about Straight Man,
uh-huh.
because when I read it, I was reminded of that you were like an American David Lodge. Have you been compared to this writer before?
Yes, of course. Sure, sure. All those academic writers of academic comedies, Robertson Davies, and of course, you know, the original Lucky Jim
from
Kingsley Amis, but to David Lodge a lot. I do get those comparisons to David Lodge, certainly.
Does that mean that you get like a pass at like the super awesome secret author table? Like that you and David Lodge get to sit next to each other at the annual meeting of super awesome authors?
I'm not sure I'm
I imagine that all great authors get invited to like a secret awesome dinner.
Oh, if only that were so, and if only I were invited. Maybe I'm sure that does happen now that you mention it, but I've not been invited.
No, who would you put at your table?
Who would I have at my table of
super awesome writers?
You know, it's funny. I always think of that story that's told about who was it? Was it? I think James Joyce might have been one of the authors, the two just titans of literature who came together in a room and they were introduced, and one said, "Hello, I've always admired your work," and the other said, "Yes, and I've admired yours," and that was the end of the conversation. when I get together with writer friends, we tend to talk about everything else. We talk about baseball. So I think the super writers table would be talking about the kinds of things that would just horrify you if you were there to, you know, they talk about, I don't know, advances in movie deals and problems with their agents, and just they're just like other human beings, totally vain, totally self-absorbed.
Totally wondering what's for dinner.
Yeah.
Is there another question out there? I think there's up there. There's some folks.
In talking about Joy and some of the other characters, you make it sound as though they have a life of their own, as opposed to something that you fabricated. Is that just a figure of speech, or does when you get into a book, does a character sort of adopt a life of her own and go places where you didn't really expect or understand or predict that he or she would?
I write books for the same reason that I read them, to find out what happens next. I don't possess a lot of knowledge at the beginning of these things. Part of the reason that it looks like that from the other end of the telescope when a book comes out is that it just takes me so long to write them. And Bridge of Sighs took the longest. That was about 7 years. When you spend 7 years with fictional characters, they do begin to take on as much life, and you understand them at least as well as you understand people in real life. And so when writers talk about their characters that way, I don't think we mean to be mystical exactly. I think it's just a feature of how long we spend with them and how many surprises hopefully the good characters do have for us along the way, if we're paying attention and listening to them instead of just, you know, moving them around the stage like puppets.
I hate to choose. It's awful. It's really hard.
Hi, I'm interested in your object art project. Uh-huh. I'm wondering if you ever did any sort of alternative art project, literary things before, and whether or not working on this project is giving you ideas or informing how you approach narrative for the future.
No, I've never done anything like this before. And I don't think it would have occurred to me if I didn't have an artist as a daughter, and she wasn't married to an artist. But the fact that they are, and the fact that they were interested in doing something like this, also made me more cognizant of certain, especially literary magazines that I'm particularly drawn to right now. I just finished being a judge for this year's Best American Short Story, so I was reading a lot more magazines than I had read before, and some that I knew the existence of but would read irregularly. But when I was judging for Best American Short Stories, I just couldn't wait for the new edition of or the new issue, the next issue of McSweeney's to come out, because it's just such a beautiful magazine. The production values are so extraordinary, and because it is kind of outsized, and they don't want it to look like everything else. And Tin House, not only is that just a great magazine with great fiction and nonfiction, it's just such a joy to hold in your hand. And so as we started talking about this, I've become much more aware. And I just read recently too, Larry McMurtry's written a wonderful book about books called Books. It's a slender little volume. It's wonderful. It's about his kind of adventures over a lifetime of buying books. And he's basically gone into his, I don't know if you know this story or not, but he's gone into his hometown of Archer City, which is not very big. It has probably half a dozen commercial buildings. He just basically bought his hometown. And he's filled all of those buildings with books, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books. But many of them are books that he just likes the looks of. They're just bound particularly beautifully And reading that particular book, as I'm thinking about doing something like that, just reminded me too of just how beautiful these things can be when we pay attention. This gentleman right down here in the front has had a hand up for a while.
I've always wanted to ask a writer this. What was the day like that you got the notice that you won the Pulitzer? What was that like for you that day?
It was a day as any other. it was interesting because I knew that the Pulitzer was going to be announced that day, and I also knew that I wasn't going to get it. So those were the two things it was an enormous surprise because the Pulitzer is the last of the major awards to be announced, of course. And not only had it not won any of the other awards, it had not even been shortlisted for them. It had not been shortlisted for the National Book Award or the National Book Critics Circle Award or for the Penn Faulkner Award or even for the more regional awards, the New England Book Awards. It had garnered wonderful reviews, and I certainly didn't have anything to complain about in terms of got the front page of the New York Times Book Review. It was living a charmed life. But the other major awards had come and gone, and I thought, all right, I was working on Bridge of Sighs already, and rather than sit around waiting for the telephone to ring when it's not going to, I went out and played tennis with a friend of mine, and we went long. As a matter of fact, we played an extra half hour to finish a set, and when I got back home, I pulled up into the driveway and looked up, and suddenly my wife was standing there on the porch, and there was a look on her face where either somebody we knew and loved had died or I'd won the Pulitzer. And I went inside, and the phone was ringing, as it had been for the last 45... Actually, she was kind of pissed. The phone had been ringing for the last 45 minutes. I went in, and I picked it up, and... this was probably 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon. I talked on the phone until about 10 o'clock that night. Hung up the phone, and the next day, literally, we were supposed to be on a plane. My Spanish publisher was bringing Empire Falls out in Spain. She had concluded as soon as she heard that the book had won the Pulitzer, she assumed I wasn't coming. But we unplugged the phone from the wall. We drove down to Boston. I got on a flight to Spain. We went to Spain and I forget where else. And we actually stopped in Italy in Venice for 2 or 3 days. By the time we got back, I plugged the phone into the wall and it didn't ring for 3 days. It was over. In the amount of time that it takes to go to Spain and spend a couple of days in Venice.
I think we have two more questions. There's somebody way over here up front.
Excuse me. I'm a master's student in writing fiction, and one of the things that I've heard suggested is that the goal of writing literature is to write something that can't be filmed. And I wonder, as a crossover screenwriter of novelist, what the differences are that you see between the two genres?
Well, there's certain kinds of novels that I think probably shouldn't be filmed, and they just tend to be very interior. There's certain things that movies do just wonderfully well, and I don't think what we're talking about now is necessarily even books that are we're not talking necessarily about. Contemporary novels, anything that you are writing or your fellow students are writing or your professors are writing or anything like that. You can just look at two 19th century novelists, two great 19th century novelists, and you can say Dickens and James, wonderful writers, and there have been so many great movies done from Dickens novels because he's a very filmic writer before there was any such thing as film. He just shows you where to place the camera, what to shoot. His characters talk wonderfully. They behave. He doesn't spend an extraordinary amount of time in their heads. Those novels, you can pick a Dickens novel and I mean, we're getting one right after another. Great adaptations of recently on television, PBS, of Our Mutual Friend, of Little Dorrit. There's almost nothing of his that has not been filmed and filmed well. You see far less Henry James being filmed, I think, and almost every time someone does it, you almost wish they wouldn't. No, you don't. Oh, let me get rid of the word almost. He's a great writer, but just so much of his, what he's doing is interior. The camera can't get there, and the shorter works tend to do better. And probably the best thing of James that's ever been filmed is, interestingly, The Turn of the Screw, which is a ghost story, of a sort, and. So no, I would disagree with the premise. And as a matter of fact, because I've done both things, when I come back to writing fiction after writing screenplays, I do from time to time, or I did for a while. I would write a passage from Empire Falls or Bridge of Sighs, and I would think to myself, all right, just try and film this, you know. And I think to myself, oh, I pity the poor son of a gun that's going to be who's going to have to write the screenplay for this. But I stopped doing that because it was me in Empire Falls. And some of those moments when I was most proud of myself for doing something that would not translate well into film, something that would flummox the screenwriter. You can't take much joy in that after it turns out to be you.
Okay, there's time for one more. You get to pick.
Gentleman way in the back there. And if you had a question, I'm going to be out. We're going to be signing books after this too. And if we've missed you or something like that, and you want to ask me after this, we can do that too. Sure.
In regard to structure, and since I read Straight Man last week, I'd like to apply humor to this question as well. Mm-hmm. So in regard to structure and humor, do you have an outline? Do you know where you're going, or are you more spontaneous? Because, I mean, there were many laugh-out-loud moments in Straight Man. And does that stuff just come to you, or do you think that out? Also in regard to the, you know, three acts or whatever structure of the novel.
Well, with screenplays, actually, I've become much more, in my novel writing, I've become much more aware of structure and the importance of structure since I started writing screenplays. Because I think with screenplays, you do have to start thinking about structure, and specifically three-act structure, much earlier. And you're much more likely to be spinning your wheels if you don't. It's going to have to be 120 pages. The first act is going to have to be 20, 25. And if you don't want to indulge third act overkill, which I don't, the final act should probably be another 20 or 25. So I start thinking about structure very early when I'm writing a screenplay. And because of that, I've now started thinking about it a little bit earlier in novels. When I was writing Straight Man, I didn't know any of that. Straight Man, as many of you know, is a story about a man trying to pass a stone. And so the structure of that novel is a man, we learn in the first chapter, is trying to pass a stone, and the book is over when he passes it. So how's that for a literary device, a structure for a novel? And there were other, as I went along, I realized that there would be other structural principles, but that's the basic structure of that novel is a man trying to pass a stone and who finally succeeds.
Also works for the comedy question.
Yeah, it works for the comedy question too. That's another. Obviously, not a tragedy that you're writing there. If that's your premise.
So, Justin, can we take one more, or are we done? Okay. So, thank you very much to Richard Russo.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of